Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 72. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about Batman Begins. That's right, we're going all the way back to 2005 to talk about a film that is well worth the conversation. Joining me on the show is J.R. Forresteros. You probably know him from the Storyman podcast or one of his many other podcasts, Don't Split Up, Origami Elephants, Bible Bites, or any of his writings over at Norval Rogers. Also joining us again on the show is Rick Lee James. You may know him from the Voices in My Head podcast. He's been with us a couple times. Always a great guest. So you can find all the links to their stuff, the ways to get a hold of them, conversate with them over at our website, which is www.realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. There's new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, and podcasts, stuff posted daily over there. So make sure you're checking us out. Check us out on Facebook at Real World Theology. Follow us on Twitter for the latest articles that we put up, links that we find fascinating, and just general notes about what podcasts, guests, and anything else we have. That's at Real World Theo on Twitter. Subscribe to the podcast, guys. It's the easiest way to make sure you're getting every episode. You can look for new episodes of the show every 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. So right now we're doing three times a month. So know that's our general schedule. You can use Feedburner, Stitcher, or iTunes. Please, please, please rate and review the show. It helps us immensely. The more ratings and the more reviews we get, especially those 5-star reviews, we'll get our name out there, more people will find us, and we'll get more people involved in the conversation. And the more people involved, typically the better the conversation is, the more questions we get, the more interactions we get. It's just really fun. And speaking of fun, we have a really great show here on episode 72. Just talking about Batman Begins, there is so much to talk about in this Christopher Nolan reboot. It's iconic. There's just so much to talk about between the justice and fear and all this stuff. And, you know, set it paving the way for one of the greatest trilogies in history. So here it is, episode 72, Batman Begins and Being Ruled by Fear. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So we're going on and on and on about Marvel, which I guess is ironic a little bit, based on the reason we're here.
Yeah.
And to switch gears to DC, I want to throw this out to start our conversation. And I have a pretty good idea what JR's answer is going to be.
Because I'm predictable.
Not because you're predictable, but based on empirical evidence. I would say the big question that I want to throw out at the beginning of this episode is one that all audiences are going to be saddled with next year, which is Batman or Superman. And so I didn't actually know, like I said, pretty confident where JR is going to land, but I'd love to hear him kind of nuance that answer. But Rick, where are you? Because I'm pretty sure when I'm following you on Facebook, you're pretty big Superman guy.
Well, it's so hard for me because I love them both so much. I really do. I've got such a different love for such different reasons. But and I'm also a pretty big fan ever since I saw him in The Tudors of Henry Cavill or Cavill or however you pronounce his last name. I just think he's a really good actor. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoyed him and his performance probably more than even the films, you know, but I'll probably – let me side it with Superman because I do like Superman an awful lot. And I know JR is like – he's got his bat beard and everything. I mean everything about him is bat. So, you know, I'll just –
because
go
he's with, predictable.
I'm a one-trick pony and it's a Batman trick.
No, and no, I have it would probably be a toss up for me too, because I've got thousands of comics, and I don't know which I have more of, Batman or Superman, because I have tons of both of them, probably hundreds of each, and I just kind of, you know, those two were my heroes. I'm really more of a DC guy than I am a Marvel guy, at least as a kid, and mm-hmm. I branched out more later on, but those have always been my two guys. So they're just nobody. I mean, I'm not saying nobody, but as far as I'm concerned, I am one of the most excited people on the planet just to see the two of them on film together, because mm-hmm. that's like, oh, I never would have thought that would have happened a million years. But I will go with Superman for the sake of this conversation.
Because it makes good radio.
That's right.
It makes great. Yeah, now we're going to have an ESPN show. So I'm going to expect both of you to yell at each other. Neither one of you have to make factual points, but whoever yells loudest wins. So it's not, like I said, this is just to kick things off. So I want to frame why we enjoy these superheroes so much. So it, not necessarily just which one is it, but you can even tell me why you would normally pick Batman, or tell the audience or discuss why you would normally pick Batman, but why you would ultimately side with Superman. Like, what is it that draws you to these characters? Like, why do you love, you know, there's no one better than Batman or Superman for you, Rick?
Well, two reasons, probably because it's just sort of nostalgia too, because mm-hmm. those were the Super Friends. That's what I grew up watching, and so that's part of it. But as I've gotten to know the characters more, I think for both of them, I feel a really strong ability to tell a Christ story with both of them, you know, in some very different ways. But I think there's still some pretty fantastic, like, lessons to learn from each. That, like I think of Batman as being, if you were going to take, like, the Christ figure, on some level, Batman is sort of the inverse of Jesus in that the Father died for the Son, you know? It's sort of this reverse characteristic thing, you know, and then the Son becomes something more. But the human side of it, whereas Superman is this sort of God figure that, you know, is so much bigger. Batman, even though he has all the riches in the world and could easily sweep himself away from all his problems, he's chosen to stay down in the alleyways and in the dark places and wherever people are victimized, so that he can carry their suffering and stop it as much as he can. So, you know, for me, it's like, wow, if you're going like the humanness of the Christ figure, you know, and what that means, that you could stay where all your riches are, but you have chosen to come down in the mud and just, you know, basically crucify yourself every night for the sake of people, and for the sake of those that, you know, your city, so to speak. So that'd be where I'd side with Batman on, you know, mm-hmm. that side of things, because I think that's a remarkable characteristic. But, you know, Superman, he's the other side. He's that side of he's just the picture of goodness. You know, he's the picture of doing. To me, he's the picture of meekness, which is the best way I can describe it is controlled power, you know. So he's somebody that has all this strength, but even, you know, the goodness that's in him that won't let him do, you know, evil, he has to even pull his punches so he won't hit his villains too hard, you know, because he doesn't want to kill them or hurt them, even though the early Superman did kill the villains, just like Batman did. But I don't know.
Yeah, but he was usually punching Hitler, to be fair, right?
Well, not in the very beginning. He's dropping, you know, slumlords off of buildings and out windows and everything else back in the early days, and he was a real, you know, macho guy or whatever, but then that changed as time went on too. So it's, you know, it's a toss-up. It would be tough to say which one I like more, but again, for the sake of this conversation, I'll just go with Superman.
So. All right, JR, like I said, if you had to, you know, pick somehow between these two, which one would you say that you identified with, or you appreciated, or followed, or cared about more?
So we're not predicting who's going to win in the
year. No, just like you know, whose side are you on? Like what? Which one interests you more?
Batman.
Okay. So not that either of us would have guessed that.
Right.
Why?
No. So here's the thing. Love Superman. I think he's a great character. The movie completely destroyed anything that was noble or good about him, but we don't have to talk about that. What I love about Superman is that he represents who we could be. Like, that's his whole thing, is to show us, like, he embodies the very best of American values, and he points us towards, like, he challenges us to aspire to be the best we could be. That's what Lex Luthor doesn't understand about him. That's when that's his arc in the comics, that's really the best. That's when he's at his best.
When he's Captain America.
Right. Yeah. It's what Man of Steel completely failed to understand about his character in any meaningful way. Mm-hmm. Batman is the person that I think rings more true in my experience. I think it's fascinating that at the end of the day, Batman is a kid who's afraid of the dark. And so rather than facing his fears and becoming whole, he dresses up like a monster and scares people and has convinced himself that that's fighting the good fight.
How does that resonate with you?
How does that make you
the Batman guy?
I think it's really a compelling story, you know. When people have tried to ask, like, what kind of sane person would dress up in a costume and beat people up at night? Well, the answer is there's no sane person. Like, no sane person would do that. Only someone who's deeply troubled and who refuses to acknowledge that they can do so. You know, I mean, it's become sort of a punchline in the comics these days that Bruce Wayne could do much more good if he just would be Bruce Wayne. Mm-hmm. But he won't be. Bruce Wayne is the mask that the Batman wears, and the Batman embodies that. He's the projection of that little kid who's sad that he lost his parents. My friend Matt Michelotis, who's one of the other Storymen co-hosts with me, said Batman's the guy who beats up. He fights evil without, because he's afraid to confront the evil within.
Mm.
You know, and I see that. I just, to me, that's the human condition. We will do anything, except actually face who we really are.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so if, like, between both of your answers, I feel like it's putting words to how I feel about both these characters, because I've never been a huge Superman fan, but I think it's because most of the times that I've seen Superman, I think he's been poorly depicted, as we've kind of mentioned in Man of Steel. And if you want to know how much we think Man of Steel was done wrong, I think it's like the second episode of this podcast.
Anything that Mark Waid ever wrote starring Superman, right?
There's that concept that I know that Superman can have great story arcs. And I love the fact that Superman is, like, I think, like both of you said, the ideal. I love him as an ideal. Unfortunately, I just never seen really compelling stories done with the ideal, or at least very often. Whereas Batman, I'm not saying there's not bad Batman stories, but I feel like because Batman is relatable, whereas Superman is something we're striving for, we don't have to strive to already understand where Batman's at. And so most of his arcs are easier to understand. They're easier to get with. We're not like, I can't ever be Superman because he's an alien from another planet. He's got superpowers. Batman, technically, except for just being the world's greatest detective, and, you know, that's not really like a superpower necessarily.
His giant pile of money is a superpower, technically.
technically, you know, so, but like, he's not got, you know, he's like a man. It's like, I think why people like Iron Man so much. Because he's a guy who's doing the most with what he's been given, which is a lot, but he's still, like, he can die. Like, I mean, Batman can't really die because he's Batman. But
Batman,
like,
Batman did die.
Well,
yeah.
Just recently in the comics.
Yeah.
Like, for real?
Yeah.
Like, until next time?
I mean, he's back, but he died.
Yeah,
he's not back. It's actually really awesome.
He got replaced by Bat Bunny Gordon for a while.
Bunny?
Yeah. It's this bat, it's mechanical, like, robot bat suit, but it looks like Bugs Bunny ears on top of it, so.
Oh, yeah, I think I've seen that drawing. I like the Kingdom Come version better, where he just gets old and he's like, I've created these robots. They're my Batman now. But, you know, he's a man, and he's relatable because he's a man. And I think there's that part that I've always liked Batman a little more, because I can relate to that. I'm like, he's a man trying to do the best he can in a jacked up world, and I feel like that's me. Whereas Superman's an ideal I'd like to shoot for, but I will probably never attain. So let me work it out in a world that's more gritty. Were you going to say something, Rick?
Well, I was just thinking as we're talking, I'm fairly late coming to this because I only saw the movie last week for the first time, but I watched it 2 days in a row, twice, because I loved it. And I'm convinced the best depiction of Superman we have is the movie The Iron Giant, if you've ever seen that. I absolutely love that movie, and I felt like there was a lot of Superman references in that film, but even like the whole idea of I think you can tell a good Superman story. You can tell a good story about, you know, what it means to be alienated because you are so different, which I think it would be fascinating to see a Superman story where Kal-El is black and grows up in, you know, a part of the world that's not Kansas, you know, like to add to the alienation of what that would mean. And then you have a secret identity that kind of even leaves you sort of even more of a societal outcast in some ways, you know, which, you know, we want to pretend that those issues are not there, but they are oftentimes. And you're thinking, well, he's an alien from another world, and he's dealing with alienation. But I felt like in the movie The Iron Giant, you have that giant in that film. Have you guys seen that?
I have not. I've heard it's fantastic.
It's really, JR?
It's really good. I mean, like, you will
it's
love
like
it.
It's in my top five, like, all time.
Mikey, I'm going to be really honest with you. You have never once told me your top five movies.
It's on Letterboxd, man. Why aren't y'all on Letterboxd? What is the problem? Iron Giant. I can't even talk about Iron Giant without getting teary eyed. It's so beautiful.
I know. It's a beautiful film, and I think they capture in that, though, like what I think could be wonderful about the Superman story. Just even because that giant is coming to understand who he is and what he can be, in spite of what, you know, what maybe he was designed for. And you know, that line, "I am not a gun," is like the greatest line in cinema, you know.
Spoiler.
And it's sort of, yeah, sorry, spoiler, yep. but you'll
getting teary-eyed.
Yeah, I mean, I'm telling you, it's amazing. And so when you think about like what that means to have all the power in the world, but to decide you're not going to be a weapon, you know, and to decide that you're going to actually, you know. So anyway, getting back, I know we want to get on to Batman, but I was just thinking as we were talking, like, wow, I just saw the best Superman movie ever, and it was The Iron Giant, you know, like it's the
no, yeah. There's obvious. I mean, it's the main. Well, it's the main thrust of the Iron Giant's arc. Directly parallel to Superman, but I never actually thought about it. If you just replaced Iron Giant with Superman, it's an amazing Superman story. Thank you, Rick. That is amazing. I love the movie even more than Superman. I already did. No, I mean, well, I think that's perfect. I think that's exactly what I wanted Man of Steel to be. And I think Man of Steel is like an act and a half away from being like, it could have been the Iron Giant.
Yeah.
And I think that's funny that we're having to say it that way. Maybe Brad Bird just like, he's like, I want to tell a good Superman story, but I don't have the rights to Superman, so I'll just make this big giant. I mean, that's
how we got The Incredibles instead of Fantastic Four 3 or whatever, yeah. Right?
That's what he's doing. He's just making really good superhero movies without the license. Okay, so like I said, I asked that so we could kind of transition to DC, understand why we like these particular comic book heroes, and specifically why we relate possibly to Batman, because in 2005, Christopher Nolan took the Batman franchise, which at the time we weren't that far removed from whatever the last Batman was. But I don't know which one it was, so I'm afraid I'm going to say it by accident.
It was Batman and that other guy.
That was the last one?
Yep.
So it wasn't
It was
BMF.
Not Batman Forever. That was the one without
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there was There was that, the Batman, which will not be named. And we, like I said, it wasn't that far removed. So it was kind of one of those situations where, like, do we really need Batman rebooted already? Because this is before we rebooted Spider-Man every year and a half. So this was new to us.
Anyone who was a Batman fan was really excited. They were just pretending that this movie's never happened and starting over.
They're like, yeah, it's been years since we've had a Batman movie. Yeah, can we like 1960-something.
Anything to wash the taste of that out of my brain.
Yeah, I remember being cautiously pessimistic, like, because I was like, oh, yep, they're going to do it again. I don't, you know, and I was like really reserved until I actually saw it. And then when I saw Batman Begins, I was like, hallelujah.
I remember watching the first trailer for the first time and going, what has God wrought?
So, okay, well, I didn't mean this to be a tangent either, but like, how do you, do you guys enjoy like the, was it 1960s Batman?
Oh yeah.
60s?
I do. Yeah.
Like all campy and terrible.
You gotta let it be what it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, Adam West was super fun.
Super fun. Okay, cool. So we all think he was super fun. I mean, weird, super fun Batman, wacky, campy Batman. Did everyone enjoy at least the first two Michael Keaton movies, like the Tim Burton films?
I know I did at the time.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I still hold, you know, a special place in my heart for that first one. Matter of fact, I'm sitting here in the studio and I have the DC Multiverse action figure of Batman Unmasked, and it's Michael Keaton's face on it. So there's a soft place in my heart for those movies, even though I know what they are at this point. And I know we like to pick on the later ones that came after Burton. But even those first two, they were a little. I mean, Batman killed everybody, you know.
Yep. Oh yeah, and those Burton was on record as saying he had never read a comic book. And
oh yeah.
Well, I'll go back even further because I have the serials of Batman from I think it's from the black and white ones where the suit doesn't even fit him right, and, you know, and it's like these
like 40s
big
or something like that.
Oh, 40s, yeah, like the big floppy ears. I've seen every one of those things because when I was a kid, that's how much I was into Batman. I was willing to sit through all of those. You know, I had them on VHS, and So yeah, there's a long history of Batman and so many iterations, you know. I think he's so adaptable as a character. Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure that the first Tim Burton Batman was the first movie I ever went to see in the theater.
Nice.
And my dad took me, and I'm pretty sure that if like the roles were reversed, you know, like if I had a child as old as I was, because I don't remember how old I was, I just know that there's no way that I would have taken me to see that movie.
Came out in 89, Mikey. How old were you in 89?
I was 7 at the time.
Okay.
So I felt like that it was a little dark for a 7-year-old, I think.
I would have been like 12, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, because some of it's like, you know, ridiculous over the top stuff. And like I said, I didn't want this to be a huge tangent, but like it was cautious, but I loved it. It didn't matter. So I was excited. I was excited in 2005 because there's going to be a new Batman because I just like Batman. And I think like we've all admitted the last few Batmans before the reboot were not memorable in any way. And we needed something different. And Christopher Nolan comes along and he's not incredibly well known at this point. And he takes this character and tells a story that I think is something that launched a trilogy that I don't think anyone would really argue is among some of the better trilogies in all of film ever.
Oh yeah.
Even, you know, like we can all argue at some other point, maybe we'll get to it on another podcast about the third one being good or bad. But, you know, you recast Christian Bale, you bring in Liam Neeson, Michael Caine, Katie Holmes, Gary Oldman, and I was so excited that Morgan Freeman was in this too, and just seeing how all these pieces wove together, and to see the, like, no one hated this film. It seemed like everyone loved it. Mm. So I would ask, is this the best iteration of Batman that we've seen to this point?
Not counting cartoons?
Ooh,
because there's some pretty good Batman.
I mean,
cartoons.
Batman the Animated Series is
really good.
Might be. I mean, that's when I read Batman comics. That's the voice I hear in my head.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's and really
cool. The biggest thing that's been missing from cinematic Batman has been the greatest detective in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fantastic DC graphic novel called Identity Crisis, and mm-hmm. it involves the murder of a few key figures in the DC universe, and Batman's not even in the first issue. It ends with a funeral, and Batman's not in it, and it's because he's out solving the case.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right, of course, right? But that's it. Like, that's Batman, and the cartoons do this tremendously well.
Yeah.
By and large, but that is an aspect of Batman I did not. I mean, The Dark Knight's one of my all-time favorite films, but I did not buy his detecting stuff in The Dark Knight. I thought that did not feel like the character that we saw in the rest of the trilogy, and certainly you could not argue that his detective skills were super integral to the plot. Of any of those films, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So, I, if we're talking strictly films, Christian Bale's Batman is by far my favorite so far, though I am confident that Batfleck will usurp him.
Yeah, I am too. But that's a hard question for me to answer as well, though, because there's so many iterations of Batman. Like, there's times I like the one that, you know, the Batman iteration where he's like the policeman's friend, as well as I like the one where he's this vigilante that doesn't want to give him the time of day, you know, like even like the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoons they had just a few years ago, which are completely kid, you know, like kid friendly and stuff. That's still an iteration of Batman that was in the comics. So it's really hard to go like, is this the definitive Batman? Because like over the time there've been so many like Batman in the comics, and it depending on the time and its history, he was really campy or hokey, or you'd see him walking down the street with the police officers and they're smiling, and then you get, you know, the Frank Miller Batman.
Exact opposite, where like he's like an urban legend and people aren't even sure if he's real. Or...
Yeah, they don't even know if he's there, really. Yeah, so it's really hard to say, but I'd say it's my favorite movie iteration as far as live action. But I have to agree. I'm a big fan of since Affleck started directing, I think he's become a better actor, and I think when he directs, the movies I've seen that he's directed have been really very wonderful, I think, you know, and very deep, and I think it's affected his acting. So I'm expecting really great things out of his Batman. If it's bad, I'm gonna be very surprised.
Yeah, I agree.
We'll have to mark this podcast and like repost it when Batman's Superman comes out, so people can be like, were they right?
Well, let me say one, if you don't mind, one thing. No. Just talking about that trailer, like, to me, that's Batman when you're seeing 9/11 happening in front of him and everybody else is running away, who doesn't even have his outfit on, and he's running as fast as he can into the falling buildings, you know? It's like, oh, like I got, you'll think I'm stupid, but I got teary. Like, I kept watching that part thinking, holy cow, like he doesn't have powers or anything. That's a hero, dude. Like, he's running into it, you know? So I'm really excited about what that could be. But until that point, yes, I'll say that Christian Bale's is the best we have so far, I guess.
Well, if it makes you feel better, Rick, when I saw that, it made me a little teary eyed too, because I was looking at that and I was like, I know Zack Snyder's going to mess this up.
Oh, right?
It made me sad.
Yeah, so. if Batman v Superman bombs, it's not going to be Affleck's fault.
Right? Yeah.
He will be the best part of that film.
I wonder if they'll... Well, all right. So, I take full responsibility for derailing our conversation.
All right.
up to this point.
You may not know what we're here to talk about today.
Yeah. We're here to talk about Batman Begins. Even though we've been talking about Batman,
you're wondering
since the beginning,
when will that conversation begin?
And it will begin right now at the something minute mark, because I don't know how much I'm going to cut off the beginning. So, the thing I wanted to make a point of was that people like just flip their lid about this movie, about how much they loved it. I was doing some preliminary, like, because this movie came out before Real World Theology started, and before lots of the lots of the podcasts or websites that we tend to link and kind of like have a good working relationship that do film and theology before they were really kind of where they are now. There's not a lot of people that I know who have reviewed this film. So I found lots of random Christian blogs and websites that reviewed this film, and almost all of them were just lauding it about how just wonderful the theology was. This one review that I read said, "The movie's worldview, however, is basically biblical. A good platform for discussion on the topics of justice, revenge, compassion, bravery, and overcoming fears." And while I definitely agree with the second half of that, whatever that assessment, the movie's worldview, however, is basically biblical.
Well, if you're from a tradition that values fear and intimidation,
I mean, like, okay, so that's kind of what I want to get at. So when I see someone write that, or when Christians watch this film, I feel like they're getting behind Batman. Batman's doing the thing. He's kicking butt. He's doing what he's got to do. He's fighting the bad guys. And, you know, everyone's like, I love justice. This is justice. But there's so much talk about justice and sacrifice in this film. And I think one of the really cool things, it's like almost no one's like got the whole picture. Everyone's got this like little piece of it, which again makes for a great conversation, again why we're here. But when you tell me that the worldview of this movie is basically biblical, there are two main lines that I think people repeat when they talk about this film. And one of them is the, you know, it's not who I am underneath, but what I do that defines me, you know, like there's that. And then there's the, why do we fall down? So we can learn to pick ourselves back up. Hmm. And my question to you guys, and I don't care which of you guys wants to jump in first, like, how do either of you think that either of these quotes kind of stack up against the Christian worldview?
Say the quote to me again, the first one. I can't remember exactly how it goes. It's not what I do in...
So, yeah, so, like, because Rachel says it to him first, to Bruce first, she says it's not what's underneath, but it's what you do that defines you.
Hmm. Well, I would say, from a Christian worldview, can it be both and, you know, at the same time that we, you know, if we believe there's a transformation that God brings about on us, like underneath, you know, if we're talking in that, not because I think we are whole people. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't what we do also be like, hopefully that would be, to be authentic, would be that we would be both of those things together, which is sort of, you know, I guess in my view of things, Christianity, and maybe this is just because I've read so many Brennan Manning books over the years, but he's constantly saying things like, leave behind your mask, you know, let the mask fall, because the person under that mask is the imposter and he's not real, you know, and in a sense, Bruce Wayne is sort of the imposter, and I get that Batman's the character. But he seems to be a character that can't exist without being two people. It kind of makes you wonder how different would things be. Does it make any difference for Batman if he doesn't have a secret identity? You know, if everybody knows who he is, does he even need that Bruce Wayne side? Like, I don't know. But I guess from a Christian worldview, I would say we would be more for being undivided in who we are, that we feel like Christ makes us whole people. So I don't know. I guess that'd be my initial thought.
You know, for that particular quote, the original, when Rachel first says it to him, it's before Bruce has left Gotham the second time, and he's about to go try to kill one of the bad guys, one of the Falcone, I think it is. And she stops him and gets in his face, and he basically says something like, you know, yeah, I'm going to go do this thing, but I'm still the same person inside. And that's where she says, it's not, you know, it's not who you are underneath, it's what you do that defines you. When he comes back, his Bruce Wayne, something fundamentally has changed, in that Bruce Wayne has become a mask. Mm-hmm. And that's something that is, that's something that's true throughout Nolan's entire trilogy. One of my favorite scenes in the entire trilogy is the masquerade ball in The Dark Knight Rises, when Bruce is dancing with Selina, and he's the only person in the room not wearing a mask. And she says, who are you supposed to be? And he says, Bruce Wayne, eccentric billionaire.
Hmm.
And that's exactly it. Like, that's the key to Batman, is that Bruce Wayne is a mask that the Batman wears.
Right.
Mm.
And so when he is doing all of these things and Rachel wants to know who he is, then he throws the line back in her face. And he says, it doesn't matter who I am. It's what I do that tells you who I am. So in that sense, I actually think that is a deeply Christian principle. That we can say we believe whatever we want, but who we are is what we do. What we do is what we really believe. Which that's straight out of the book of James, right? You believe God is one, great. So do the demons, and they shudder.
Yeah, and they shudder. That's right.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It reminds me a lot of, well, part of what, Rick, I thought you were kind of getting at, where, like, does it have to be one or the other? I think this is one of those both ands, because it's like one of those things where people are like, oh, are you with Paul? Are you with James? Like, what is it that matters most? You know, is it grace or works? And like, ultimately, I think the answer that we would all come to is like, yes. Like, because just.
Well, that's, I mean, it irritates the heck out of me when people try to say, you know, Paul and James are fighting as though they disagree in their theology. Like,
yeah,
for them, it's one thing. There's no such thing as a difference.
Yeah.
Faith and works. And that's James's whole point. He's like, look, it doesn't matter what you say. Like, it doesn't matter what you say. You can have the most beautiful, eloquent. I mean, this is, I don't know if you guys have been following all the things that have been coming out about John Howard Yoder. Really influential in several theological traditions, including the one that Rick and I are a part of. And it turns out that he had multiple inappropriate relationships with women that were students of his throughout most of his career.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, like, there are a lot of people online who are saying, well, yeah, that doesn't matter. His books are still great.
Right.
And right. James would say, no, it absolutely matters. You cannot separate the man who wrote these beautiful, tremendously insightful books from the man who abused his position to sexually abuse women.
Hmm.
Like, you can't separate those things. They're one and the same. And so, yeah, that creates tension, but you got to deal with it. You can't ignore it. You can't pretend it doesn't. You can't pretend just because you like what this person says that what they do doesn't matter.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, we always want people to be just one thing, but we have so many facets to us that we don't show. And I was thinking as we're talking about this too, you know, we tend to be a person oftentimes with the fellowship of believers that we're not elsewhere. And it's like you said, what we do does kind of show who we really are, more than just what we say. But I think it's interesting, like, if you're going to say that Batman is the ideal, you know, if church is where we all are acting like the ideal, it's like at church we're all Batman, but when we go home we act like Bruce Wayne, because that's who we really, you know, we're the selfish person that just wants all we want, and more often than not it seems like that is who we can be. And I think that's a very interesting point you're making, like about Yoder, like he was both of those things. And you know, I already mentioned Brennan Manning, you know, he always said he was an angel with an incredible appetite for beer, you know,
he was actually never allowed to come back to the college that I attended because he smoked a cigar in the guest quarters.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Wow. So yeah, and that's the really hard thing to reconcile. And yet at the same time, you know, all of those things together are the person God loves. And there's a really like profound song called The Golden Boy and the Prodigal by Jason Gray. It's a very probably obscure, because I don't know if you know much of Jason Gray's music. He's more Christian pop type stuff usually. But there's this one little song that talks about, you know, look in the mirror, tell me, who do you see, the one who Jesus died for or the one you'd like to be? You know, and I think that line is just amazing. Who would you rather be, the one who Jesus died for or the one you'd like to be?
Wow. Yeah.
And I think that, like, yeah, that's, Jesus didn't come to save cleaned up people who know how to live cleaned up lives. He came to us, you know, on our worst days, if we could truly be truthful, we would have to admit we can be just as deviant as John Howard Yoder, you know, and how deeply, you know, we need a savior for that reason. And yet it doesn't change the fact that we still are called to be one, and that should be a part of ourself that I think Christ wants us to be able to get to the point where we can admit that's who we are, you know, that, and that's why I say, I wonder if that's why, does Batman even need Bruce Wayne, you know, to be authentically who he is? Because he's, it seems like Bruce Wayne's always just a hindrance to him, you know, and that, that.
Except for Bruce Wayne's money.
Except for the money. That's right. That's right.
That small, small detail.
You know, the other quote that, you know, why do we fall so we can pick ourselves back up again? Fantastic quote, but that's one where I would say it sharply diverges from the good news about Jesus, right? Mm-hmm. I love it when people quote to me from the Bible, God helps those that help themselves.
Yes.
Right? Because that's not in the Bible. That was Benjamin Franklin.
One of the best verses.
That's a wonderfully American ideal, mm-hmm. but it is not at all a Christian ideal.
Are they the same people that, you know, you ask him what president Ben Franklin was.
Yeah, right. Third, fourth
president, right?
Well, he's got to be. He's on money, right?
Right.
They only put presidents on money.
You know, I mean, yeah, the fundamental good news of the gospel is that while we were dead, Christ died for us. When we could do nothing to accomplish our own salvation, God did everything for us. And that's the exact opposite of, you know, why do we fall so we can pick ourselves back up again? It's more mm-hmm. like, hey, don't worry. Even though you fell, God is picking you back up again. Right? I mean,
yeah, instead of learn your lesson, do work harder.
Right, just work harder next time and yeah. you'll get over this. Now, again, I am all for learning from our mistakes mm-hmm. and getting better and improving and not beating ourselves up and not staying on the ground. But unless we confess that our ability to get back up and go again is all empowered by the Spirit. And the only way we have any sort of meaningful, lasting victory over the quote-unquote falls in our own lives is because of the Spirit's work in and through us, then we're just propagating an Americanized gospel of good works that is doomed to end up failing us at some point.
It's only in cooperation with the Spirit, you know, when we finally stop resisting against and allow him to do the work. Yeah. So good answer.
And we all agree with JR.
I take his answer.
Yeah. I covet your answer, JR.
I mean, I love that part in the movie. And when it comes back in the third film, like, it's such a sweet payoff, but mm-hmm. it's a movie. It's not the Bible.
Mm-hmm. So, okay. So we've dove pretty hard into the Christian worldview piece of it, as opposed to dealing with overall theme. But there was another quote that is in this film about symbols and stuff like that. And I was wondering if either of you, I watched the movie again yesterday, and I was wondering if either of you picked up on it and or thought that it might be a critique of religion. And that's when Bruce comes back and he says people need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed. But as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting. And to me, like I said, it didn't seem like it was like a harsh critique of religion, but it looked like someone described religion to somebody and said, no wonder religion is so powerful, because look what it does. It becomes the symbol. It doesn't matter if it's real or not. It doesn't matter if this man's really like a Batman, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't really, we don't even know what his ideals are, but it's a symbol of something greater. And that's really all people need. They don't need truth necessarily. They just need something to make them feel better. Mm. Is that too light of a reading of the quote?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that the film, and certainly the larger trilogy, does that.
Okay.
I think they treat symbol much more positively. In fact, if I were assigning like atonement theory to the Dark Knight trilogy, I would say that what we're looking at is moral influence theory, which is basically similar to what we were talking about Superman does earlier. by becoming the Batman, Bruce Wayne shows Gotham that they don't have to live lives dominated and characterized by fear. He says, look, this is what it can look like if you choose to. So that's why it's important in the third movie that someone else becomes Batman, right? And that they never find out who Batman really was. Because anyone, and it's even what's happening in the second film when everyone starts being Batman, right? He's like, well, this isn't what I intended. And he's like, well, what'd you expect was going to happen? Like, you told them they didn't have to be afraid, you know? I guess to me, I saw the idea of symbol focus functioning more positively in that they help us to look outside of ourselves and look to something bigger than ourselves and participate in that bigger thing.
Well, and I think I would see it probably more in the positive too, but I could certainly see how that could be taken as a critique. But on the other hand, I just think there are some truths that are so big that maybe a story is the only way we have to contain it too, you know? And so I think when we're talking about symbolisms and things, I mean, I think they can work positively. And I think it's only fairly recently in history that we would look at things like symbols and stories and say that means it's not true, you know. I think it's a fairly recent, you know, last 100-150 years development. Like when you would take something like Noah's Ark or something, and everybody's just debating, oh, did it really happen? Well, if it didn't happen, it's not true. And the whole idea that, like, no, maybe there's a truth there that's so large that a story, you know, if it wasn't literally true, the story of it is the only way to contain the bigness and the truth of what this is. Mm-hmm. So I think that can certainly be what our symbols are about. And, you know, who's to say that those symbols are not the true thing? You know, who's to say that something that's intangible is not really true, you know, is not more real than anything that, you know, more real than the cup in front of me.
And not to keep pushing through the podcast, but that's what the Dark Knight does, right? The Joker tells the criminals, he's like, why are you hiding in the daylight? Right? It's because you're afraid of a symbol. You're afraid of what he has represented to the city. It's not just the Batman. Now all of a sudden the judges will prosecute you and the cops will arrest you and the detectives will investigate you.
Yeah.
Why? Because something bigger than, you know, bigger has happened.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, and so maybe it becomes less of a critique of symbols in general and more, if it ever was, and more of a keen observation of humanity. Because that's what I like about lots of our stories that we're told, especially films. I think lots of times they end up saying, does everyone else realize that people are like this?
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, oh, yeah, we kind of are.
Yes.
And in this case, it says people need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy. And that this might be something that humanity needs. We need something bigger than ourselves to look to, or we'll, you know, what is it that Rise says? Something about, like, you call what these people have lives. You know, we need something to shake us out of that. Or it would be like all those other movies where we're just drones in the machine, you know?
Yeah.
So in Batman Begins, we have the story starts and we get thrown right into Bruce kind of escaping Gotham, being somewhere across the world, you know, in the dredges of society, of some other society. Learning from villainy and scum and just being among those type people until he runs across a man, Liam Neeson, who it's now 2015. This movie's 10 years old. Spoiler alert. You know, pause.
10 years.
Batman was
only 65 when it came out.
That's right. So he runs across who will eventually be revealed as Ra's al Ghul. And
now, real quick, just a fun little fact.
Okay.
He originally introduces himself as Henri Ducard.
There you go.
There is a story arc where you find out that a man named Henri Ducard actually trained Bruce Wayne. Right. So, for the comics fans, when he was introduced at that way, like, comics fans are like, oh, cool, like, they're going, like, deep with this. So it was a really not for the people who were more likely to know about Ra's al Ghul, it was a really nice fake out.
Yeah.
As someone who had only seen Ra's al Ghul, I think, in the animated series, and not, I don't remember a lot in the animated series that gave me a ton of backstory about it. But it's been a long time since I've seen the animated series. Like, I didn't know what Ra's al Ghul was a part of necessarily, and I couldn't remember. So I was still pretty faked out. Until things happen and he saves his life, and I'm like, okay. Because you can't, Liam Neeson doesn't die in the first act.
He's in the League of Shadows.
That's right. So, you know, so uh-huh. Bruce Wayne runs across the League of Shadows, and I have this entire section right here where when I watched this yesterday, I just was like, I just want to talk to JR and Rick about the League of Shadows theology. Because I am really, like, I'm not exactly sure if I completely understand it. And I have, like, four or five quotes, because every time Liam Neeson's on screen, he's basically espousing some kind of worldview or some kind of idea of what justice is or what justice isn't and what has to be done to make justice happen. And so I love when he's on screen posturing for the League of Shadows. And so he says things like, Gotham's time has come. Like Constantinople or Rome before it, the city has become a breeding ground for suffering and injustice. It is beyond saving, and it must be allowed to die. This is the most important function of the League of Shadows. It's one they've done forever. And then when he gets pushback from Bruce Wayne, he goes, only a cynical man would call what these people have lives. Crime, despair, this is not how man was supposed to live. The League of Shadows has been a check against human corruption for thousands of years. We sacked Rome, loaded trade ships with plague rats, burned London to the ground. Every time a civilization reaches the pinnacle of its decadence, we return to restore the balance. And at first glance, does this not seem to have, like, some kind of allusion to what, like, God's role in, like, the Tower of Babel was?
Right.
Like, in, like, Old Testament, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And if it is, and what God did was good, like, where are the League of Shadows going wrong? Like what, they're in their end game, how are they missing the boat? Because they're the bad guys, they have to be missing the boat, right?
Well, I suppose it depends on whether or not you consider the incarnation of God as divine love in the person of Jesus Christ to, overshadow the Tower of Babel or not.
Yeah. Well,
okay, so unpack that, JR.
Well, I mean, we believe that Jesus is the fullest revelation of God's love and God's self, and so we actually read everything in Scripture through the lens of Jesus, and we would look at something like the Tower of Babel and say, you know, if that's not completely consistent with the character of Christ, then we modify our understanding of Babel, not our understanding of Christ. Right?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
So if we say, is God all about, like, genocide of a city so that they learn from their wicked ways, we can look at the book of Jonah or, again, just about anything Jesus did and say, probably not.
Well, and it's again, I think you're talking about the matter of, you know, we want to make Christ submit to Scripture rather than the Scripture submit to Christ. And I think that's what you're saying is very interesting, both of you guys, because I think, you know, growing up, that's the League of Shadows is how I was in many ways taught to look at God. And I still hear to this day, well, if this country doesn't get God back in it, we're going to fall just like, you know, God's going to strike us just like every nation.
Sodom
before.
And Gomorrah.
Exactly. So I think what you're saying, Mikey, is like, wow, I never put that together. But in many ways, I think that's probably, unfortunately, the view I held of God for a long time. And yet again, what JR's saying is Jesus changes everything. And he reminds us that you know, as the saying goes, God has always looked like Jesus. We just haven't always known it. Oh, what was that? Somebody's doing acrobatics. JR's typing, I think. But I do think that's a really good observation you made, though. I never thought about that with the League of Shadows. But gosh, I do think that was probably, I mean, that's the view of God I held for so long, you know.
Well, it's just crazy because he says all this stuff and it sounds like Old Testament biblical wrath of God stuff. Like,
yeah.
You know, basically these people are flying too close to the sun, yeah, and they're going to get burnt. You know, yeah, that's why he says, when a forest grows too wild, a purging fire is inevitable and natural. And I think that's part of what happens. I think that is something that is in place in the world. I think when we get too haughty, when we get too far from God, when we get too full of ourselves, that's when we're going to crash. Mm. Like, I think that's a law of nature that we have. I mean, that's why God is needed. That's why God is necessary. Mm. And I think if I had to argue, like, specifically where I think the League goes wrong, it's in two places. And one is when he says that, you know, he's talking about, like, Constantinople and Rome, and he says they're a breeding ground for suffering and injustice. They are beyond saving. And so I think, one, boom. When something is beyond saving, I think we start to have issues theologically.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when that judgment is being made by a man.
Yeah.
You know? Unless God comes down and says, like, they are beyond saving. And even then, we see in Scripture where people are like, yeah, you're going to destroy them, God? Please, you know, don't. And, you know, God's moved by people's words.
Mm-hmm.
And prayers and petitions. And so I feel like that's way off. And then later, when Ra's al Ghul is talking to Bruce again, and he's telling him that basically Bruce's compassion is a weakness, he says that, or Ra's al Ghul says, if someone gets in the way of true justice, you just walk up behind them and stab them in the heart.
Ugh.
And I'm like, it's so, I mean, like, I can't imagine that's not written to be intentionally ironic. Because how could true justice ever look like stabbing someone in the back through the heart?
Yeah.
Like, what is just about that?
And yet, I mean, I think it could be argued that even theologians throughout history, Martin Luther being one of them, you know, he definitely held this worldview of, or Calvin or whoever, a lot of them throughout history have, not to just pick on those two guys, because there's many more, but I mean, they specifically had theologies of, like, you know, Martin Luther wanted to wipe out the entire Jewish race because they rejected Jesus. So let's just, yeah, you know, and it turned that way with Catholics too, or, you know, and it was, for many times throughout church history, I think a lot of theologians espouse views like that. You know, if they're going to get in the way of Christ, just kill them and be done with it. And, you know, and it didn't seem to be any problem with that because they started killing them, you know. Mm-hmm. And yet I think we know now that is the least Christ-like thing we could possibly think of, that Jesus didn't come to kill people. He came to die for people. Mm-hmm. And So we
were talking about Ra's al Ghul. We're doing Ra's now?
I think it's Ra's, but I think I heard Denny O'Neill, I believe he's the one that created him. I think I heard him on a podcast say it's pronounced Ra's al Ghul, but they've never done it that way in the movies. So
They're doing that, however, on Arrow sometimes.
Okay.
Literally in the last, like, he's in the last, like, six or seven episodes of the last season that just aired. Mm-hmm. And in the episodes that he is in, there are minimum of three different pronunciations of his name from him, from other people in League of Shadows, and from Team Arrow. It's hilarious.
Yep. That's that quality control of CW. That's why I am done watching Arrow.
Race, Rash, Raz.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, so Mr. Al Ghul, says something that is actually in conflict about justice to something Rachel says later in Batman Begins, or actually she says earlier, because you know, Mr. Al Ghul comes in and says things that he's already heard people like Rachel or Alfred say, or his father, and he kind of flips them on their head. And Ra's al Ghul says, "Justice is balance." Whereas Rachel says, "Justice is about harmony." Hmm. Because in Rachel's thing, she's basically mad at Bruce because he admits that he was going to kill Chill, the person who killed his parents. Mm-hmm. And Rachel says, "You're not talking about justice, you're talking about revenge." And Bruce says, "Sometimes they're the same." Oh. And she retorts, "No, they're never the same, Bruce. Justice is about harmony. Revenge is about you making yourself feel better." Oh. And it's really interesting to me because when I hear, again, Mr. Al Ghul say, "Justice is balance," I think eye for an eye.
Every time you say that, I think Al Gore, and I want to say Ra's al Ghul.
Ra's al Ghul.
That's the next way it's going to be pronounced on Arrow.
I mean, to be fair, I think he's really concerned about the environment also. So.
Yeah. Because people are destroying it.
So. You know, in theological terms, Mikey, I found it helpful to talk about these two competing ideals of justice as retributive justice and restorative justice.
Mm-hmm.
So retributive justice is that eye for an eye. It's mm-hmm. balance. It's if you do something to me, then the scales of the universe are out of balance, and the way to rebalance them is to do back to you what you did to me. And the reason we have to have an outside, blind, third-party justice system that is objective and neutral is because the offended party always perceives the offense to be greater than the offending party. So if you do something to me, I'm going to perceive it as a greater, deeper offense. So when I retaliate, you're going to perceive it as overkill, right? And mm-hmm. then that's the you know, the myth of redemptive violence and the cycle of escalating mm-hmm. violence, and it's never going to get better. So if that's our view of justice, we have to have a retributive justice system that is objective, which is why today, like in our prison systems, people pay their debt to society, right? that's what that language comes from, right? They did something wrong. They owe a debt, and an objective, blind, third-party justice system says this is a just punishment, right? This is you paying your debt.
Well, outside of that system, this is where people would also probably bring in the notion of karma, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like there's an imbalance in the universe, and yep. something is just trying to fix the scales.
Something is. God yeah. or the universe or whatever. Yeah. So the other option that we have, and it's one that the prophets and that Jesus advocate, is restorative justice, which is not everyone gets what they deserve. It's more of the harmony idea that Rachel's advocating, which is everyone gets what they need to flourish. Mm-hmm. So a family with five kids obviously needs more to flourish than, a single person or a couple with no children.
Right.
Right. Someone,
but that's not fair, JR. This is America.
Well, it depends.
If everything's equal.
It depends on your view of justice, right? If justice is everyone gets the same, and everything's fair and balanced, then it is unfair.
You mean like Fox News?
I was gonna let it go, but you went ahead and went there.
I could not, right?
Yeah, but I mean that's exactly it, right? Restorative justice says, yeah, people don't need the same. Someone who comes from a two-parent upper or middle class home has different needs than someone who comes from a single parent family in an urban environment. Right? Yeah. They do. They have different needs. They need different things if both of those people are going to flourish. And what is just is not making sure they have the same everything, the same scholarships and all of that. What's just is making sure they both have what they need to flourish.
Right, exactly.
But ultimately, if either of them just pull themselves up by their bootstraps,
right? If they just they realize that the reason they fall is so that they can get back up again.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I think you're correct, and I see that all the more because one of my very good friends, Brandon Sipes, he worked for a good bit of time here in Springfield, working with the juvenile detention center, and it really is a matter of of going in and trying to figure out what these kids need, you know, and they're all coming from such different backgrounds and such hard backgrounds. When you start hearing their story, you start understanding why they're there in the first place and what brought them to the place that takes them there. And the only way to help them is to figure out, you know, really how to help them, not just give everyone a one-size-fits-all program, so to speak. Although in some cases, those programs are very helpful that they have to do. But yeah, that statement about harmony versus balance, I don't know that we ever get balance. I think that's part of grace anyway, is God being better to us than what we deserve. And and so, yeah, JR is just, I could just sit and listen to JR all night.
JR's on fire tonight. He brought his A-plus game.
I told you I was going to bring my A-plus game.
The only thing I could think of the whole time he was talking was Fox News is to news as Fox Fantastic Four is to the Fantastic Four.
Oh, gosh. Rick wins the podcast. Thanks, everyone. You've been a great audience. Tip your servers.
That's right.
No, I got to cut that out right out of the middle so I can put that as the end. When you were talking, JR, what it reminded me of was, I feel like this has been floating around the internet for years now, so you've probably seen it in some iteration as a meme or a quick link as an article or something like that, but I think the immediate reaction of most people is that justice should be balanced. It should be an eye. That's why people go around saying an eye for an eye. You hit me, you get to hit them, and everyone's okay. All right. You did that. You get to do, you know, you slept with someone, so I'm going to go sleep with someone, and then our relationship's going to be better because that's balance. And there's this concept that even in science, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Like, it's like these principles that the world is founded on. So there's this interview with Bono, and he talks about how he can totally believe that karma is a real thing. That the universe works on a principle of balance. And the reason that Christ is so amazing is because he changes it from balance to basically that harmony, to that restorative justice, to say, there's nothing that you can do that is equal and opposite from what you've done to fix yourself. So someone has come in and paid that justice for you and made karma irrelevant, he's flipped the physics of the universe on its head and saying, I know this is how things seem to work all the time, but that's why this is even more important, because there would be no other way out. And while, you know, it incenses some people that, you know, someone would even entertain the idea of karma, seeing it's very Eastern and whatnot, I thought it was very telling, in kind of one of those ways that, Rick, you were talking about earlier. Sometimes it doesn't matter if the actual specific story is true, because a story holds a truth that has an idea that is more true than whether the event happens.
Right.
So in this particular case, I don't think Bono really cares if karma is real. He's saying, so in a world where karma would be real, Jesus is even more magnificent.
Yeah. Well, and we would do well to remember that, one, the Bible is an Eastern document, not a Western document. Mm-hmm. It's from the Middle East.
The Middle West.
And
the Midwest.
And two, whenever I teach about karma, I go to Deuteronomistic theology. If you do well, God will bless you. And if mm-hmm. if you are evil, God will curse you. That's karma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is. It's wrapped up in Old Testament scripture instead of in the Rig Vedas, but it's karma, right?
Yeah.
And Bono's right on. Like, that's the good news about Jesus, is he obliterates the karmic system or the Deuteronomistic system or whatever mm-hmm. title you want to give it. He obliterates eye for an eye.
So if we take that one step further, the last question that I want to ask is more of a hypothetical, because it's something that I was kind of scratching my head about at the end of Batman Begins. And that's, they make a big deal to point out how it's Thomas Wayne. Isn't that his dad's name?
Thomas Wayne.
Yeah. Thomas Wayne. That he is a well-to-do person, and he basically sacrifices. Like, he doesn't fight people. All he does is serve. He serves and gives away. He serves and gives away. And he serves and gives away. And ultimately, it's his death kind of like a missionary, you know, who's killed by the people that they're preaching the gospel to. Like, that's more of a testament, like, you know, the martyrs of the past. That actually, you know, is pointed out to have changed the heart of Gotham at least a little bit. Getting it going in the right direction. Whereas Bruce hears this all his life. He hears it when he's young. He sees it when he's young. He hears it when he comes back. And Alfred keeps telling it to him over and over and over again. And he still chooses something that does not seem quite the same. Do you see it as the same path? Just it looks different? Or is he just completely choosing something that looks different from his father's for different reasons?
If you take it from the movie, it seems to me like he's choosing a different path than his father. I mean, we even see right down to when Thomas is killed, he's doing his best to calm the man with the gun. You know, mm-hmm. He's not like, I'll get you for this, you know, or he's very much like, it's okay. It's okay. You know, he's just like being very like, how I would hope I would be in that scenario, when in actuality I'd be wetting my pants, but, or whatever you do in that scenario. But, it seems like Bruce's father is a man of action, but not a man of violence. And it seems like Bruce feels like the only way he can do it is through violence. Even if he doesn't kill, still he's gonna, you know, beat the crap out of the bad guy, you know, one way or the other.
Through redemptive violence.
Through redemptive violence, exactly. So I don't know. It might be a similar path, but I don't think it's exactly the same. But it would be a really boring story if Batman never punched a guy, you know, or did anything. It would just be, you know, Batman calming people down, and that's not really the...
Hey guys.
It'd be Batman doing Black Widow's lullaby that she does to the Hulk, you know, calm down, quiet, you know, and that doesn't make near as interesting a story. But I don't know. I don't think they're exactly the same path in that regard, I guess I would say. They both want the same thing, but, you know, it'd be interesting. I'm just going to wait and hear what JR says, because he'll say something he'll say something brilliant, and I'll be like, yep, that's what I agree with right there. So.
No pressure, JR.
Well, what I was going to say before that was, yeah, you know, it's interesting that in some ways, Batman and Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul, agree that Gotham is... Well, I guess they don't quite agree, but Batman will admit that Gotham is nearly lost. Not quite lost, right?
Yeah.
But he still thinks they can be saved. So there's something of an idea of his vision is to rebuild Gotham, but first the rotten heart has to be cut out.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and so that's his idea with the Batman persona, and that's essentially, I mean, if you look at Batman or at the Dark Knight, and especially at the Dark Knight Rises, that he does, like he cuts out the criminal element and has them so on the run that mm-hmm. they do not define the character of Gotham even by the opening of the Dark Knight,
right.
And so all of the Thomas Wayne type stuff that the Bruce Wayne persona wants to do can flourish, because this dark, corrupted underbelly of corrupt officials and gangsters who have no social checks on them, all of that has been cut out by the end of the first film.
Which is why we'll see in The Dark Knight him like doing fundraisers for Harvey Dent, somebody who believes can actually now
okay. be a legitimate face of this. Like he's gotten the gunk out, so now someone can come in and take over and be the White Knight that he could never be, right?
Yeah.
So I think he wants the Thomas Wayne kind of stuff to flourish and be successful. He wants to create a world where no more Joe Chills get made. But by the time he engages in that endeavor, from his perspective and Ra's al Ghul's perspective, something dramatic has to happen first. Right? Like, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, I think the moral at the end of the trilogy, though, is that as long as people are people, we're always going to need a Batman.
And as long as people are people, will always relate to Batman.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's why, right? Because again, at the end of the day, we'd rather blame it on mobsters and jokers and Banes than on ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think we see.
I should have said terrorists instead of Banes, right? That would have been way more relevant.
That's right. Well, and don't you see it like now? I'm a parent, so I might have a slightly different perspective on this, but the way that we do things, we always want to say it has to be one way or the other too. And it's very interesting to me because I'm looking back at my life now and seeing the way that my parents raised me, and my dad was a preacher, and so I'm trying to keep that in mind as I'm raising my son too, lessons I'm learning from them. But one thing I remember is my dad being in a pulpit and speaking words of grace and peace and, you know, telling people about Jesus while I'm acting out on the front row as like a 6-year-old or something. And right in the middle of my dad preaching about the love of Christ, he like gets this stern like voice and he points his finger at me and he's like, "That's enough now." You know, like like immediately, and I like got quiet because I know Dad's mad, and then he's back to being, you know, the grace-filled preacher again, right? At that same moment, and again, it's like that's not really like a failing of my dad; it's just who we are as humans, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. so you're trying to like you are espousing this grace, and yet at the same time, you get this kid in the corner that needs a whack, you know, and you don't know what to do about it, so. And I think that's a conundrum. We're just always faced with those things as human, and we'd like to pretend that we're one or the other, and maybe even, you know, we have a hard time maybe in our setting now of seeing Jesus as being that way too. But the Jesus, you know, he does have the right to judge us, or you know, we would talk about maybe using the rod or whatever, but I think that we see that Jesus's judgment towards us actually is grace and is mercy, and so he's different than us in that regard. But yeah, again, how as humans, how do we pick one side or the other? Because we are both of those things. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on Rick totally one-upping JR there at the end.
Sorry. Probably better call it. It's not going to get better than that.
Better call it. You know, just cutting it off right there. So I acknowledge, and I think we all would, that especially if we went almost did like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of like through this movie, there would be so many things that we get on, so many themes, and it's definitely worth conversation. Obviously, we're revisiting it after 10 years. So we haven't hit anything, and we would love to continue those conversations, but kind of wrapping us up, I do want to say, are there any moments in this film that are come-on moments? Are there anything that, like, watching it again, watching it 10 years later, kind of make you roll your eyes?
Just overall, I get really tired of that voice when he's Batman. I mean, it just, to the point, sometimes as much as I love the movies, I don't want to watch it again because, like, he's going to do that voice again, you know?
Especially when he doesn't need to, when he's, like, talking to Alfred.
Exactly. And now all I can see is Pete Holmes doing the, yeah. you know, the voice.
Exactly.
But
it's not nearly as bad in Batman Begins.
It's not, but
it gets dramatically worse in The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. So I don't know, but overall, I don't have a lot of problems with those films. I mean, I really do. I do like them. The voice is always a stumbling block to me. And in the first one, I'm not the world's biggest fan of Katie Holmes. I think she's fine in that, but I do like Maggie Gyllenhaal a lot. And I just as far as an actress, that's a little more believable in that role. I always felt like Katie Holmes was like, she looked like a teenager, and I'm like, how did she get to be assistant DA at the age of 19, you know?
Scientology.
Yeah, exactly. Scientology, that's it. So,
don't you want a Thetan-free assistant district attorney? I know.
That's right. So those are mine, I guess.
That's fair.
Yeah, you know, okay, so first of all, the Scarecrow is one of my top-tier Batman villains. And I thought the way the film handled fear as a theme was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. But the way he is dispatched at the end of the film by a tase from Katie Holmes and then just get being galloped off on his horse was really sad.
It was unceremonial.
Yeah. Unceremonious. Yeah. And it was really sad. Now, I mean, I get like a fight between an actual fight between him and Batman would last 0.2 seconds because Scarecrow is not a fighter.
Yeah.
So I get that, but I don't know. Like, I wanted more from that character. Yeah. Well, and they gave it to us with Roz, right? I mean, they gave us,
yeah.
But I don't know. I love Scarecrow so much.
I was going to say, because in the animated series, Scarecrow is legit, like, freaky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
here's the problem with Scarecrow. I mean, he's a one-note villain, right? It's like, it's Batman has hallucinations, and he's like, Scarecrow must have invented a new fear toxin. I'll synthesize an antidote. And then for the rest of the episode, or film, or whatever, he's fine. Right? And then, so the next time, it's just like Joker gas. Like, there's a new Joker gas now. It's bad until we simulate an antidote, and then it's fine. Yeah. But at least with the Joker, there are a lot of other layers, particularly, again, with the way they did it. They did a Joker who could fight, mm-hmm. you know, who had the knives and all that kind of stuff. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I get it. I get the way they did Crane, and I like Crane. I love the guy that played him. I love that he's in mm-hmm. all three of the films. Love all of that stuff. I was just like, when that, I was like, oh, that's it? Oh. He doesn't really deserve any better, but I love him, so I wanted him to have better. And, yeah.
Yep. Also fair. So for me, it was, I felt like there were a lot of plot holes in this film that I'd never noticed the first couple times I watched it. And I don't know if it's because I've watched so many movies or I've been doing real world theology, you know, for a couple years now since I've watched Batman Begins. And it's just like things that don't make sense that really annoyed me with the Dark Knight Rises. Like that kind of plot holes.
Yeah.
Like I don't understand how you have a microwave emitter that evaporates all water, but it doesn't evaporate water from like people's bodies. because it's like
Mikey, it's only liquid water.
It's only liquid water. Like water is normal.
It can't get through your skin. Obviously it's a laser.
I mean, it can get through a pipe, but not your skin.
Yeah, pipes are metal, Mikey. I don't...
Duh.
You're so nitpicky. It's like you don't even know how lasers work.
So, I really appreciate you backing me up on that one, JR. It's just little things like that just kind of seem odd. But, like, I just enjoyed the film so much just because of what they're trying to do. The whole world that they build around Batman... like it didn't bother me as much as it could have, but I definitely saw things that I didn't know before, but that'd probably be my nitpickiness that, and they didn't really use Rachel a lot.
There's a problem in superhero films, and this critique was levied most effectively at Amazing Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
There's a problem in superhero films that the stakes always have to be the whole city or mm-hmm. the whole world or whatever. And they nearly always involve a big, ridiculous device with a countdown timer on it, right? That's in Begins and in Dark Knight Rises. Inevitably, when you do something like that, it's going to be silly. And that's why I think the first Avengers film is as compelling as it is, because, I mean, there is still a big, stupid machine, but at least there's no countdown timer. But especially The Dark Knight, I think that's why it works so well, because the real enemy is human nature. And
there is a countdown timer.
There is a countdown timer, but it's
and it not, goes off.
It's and it does, and it's but it's completely subverted, right?
Mm-hmm.
By the symbolism work, because Batman has inspired the people to believe that they don't have to be ruled by fear, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the first, you know, by the stakes of The Dark Knight are the city, but it never felt that way. Like, it was these two boatfuls of people. And at the end of the day, I mean, let's be real. If, like, those two boatfuls of people die, like, that's kind of sad. It's pretty sad. It's tragic. But it's not like a whole city died, you know?
Right.
It's like it's different stakes. And what Batman's really fighting for is just these two little boats of people. And somehow they made the fate of the city rest on this like really small scale thing that had nothing to do, like Batman and Joker aren't even there, you know, like so I wish that more superhero films would just have a no doomsday device rule.
Right.
Ant-Man did this pretty well. I mean, they kept making these grandiose speeches about how if Hydra got the suit, then it would.
Yeah. Blah, blah.
But, like, it was never, like, it never felt that immediate. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It wasn't the fate of the world. It was, can we beat this one guy?
Yeah.
And I think that's why it worked.
It was Thomas the Train scale.
Right. And I think that served the movie well, whereas with The Amazing Spider-Man is this big goofy thing that was threatening the whole city. And it's like, well, you don't need that, you know?
Especially like in what would be like an the equivalent of like an origin story.
Right. Like, right. Why can't it just be Rachel? Why can't it just be Joe Chill? Why can't it just be Falcone? Like, whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So...
All right, so let's flip it up and end with our favorite moment, Rick. What's your favorite thing about these movies, but this movie?
Oh gosh, man, why am I not prepared? I like the movie so much. gosh, can you come back to me? Wait, I don't know. I have trouble with a favorite moment, I guess.
Just picture us all in our underwear. Like our tights, like Superman.
That's right. That's not my favorite moment. Let's see. Gosh, I don't know. There's parts of it I really like. I don't know. Can you go to JR first? And I need to think about it a minute because I'm so sorry.
So I have a small moment, and then I have my legit favorite part.
Okay.
My small moment is when Batman gives Scarecrow the fear toxin.
Mm-hmm.
And then Scarecrow sees like the demonic Batman questioning him. That's terrifying and awesome. Like, it's so scary. Yeah. that was just great. But I think my legit favorite part is when the first sequence where he's the Batman at the shipyard. And he's jumping around through the shipping containers and all that kind of stuff. And the guy's like, where are you? And he's right behind me. He's like, behind here. And yeah, I mean, just all of that was just so awesome. Like, so awesome. I loved that. It really encapsulated for me everything that makes Batman awesome.
Ninja.
Well, I'm going to go for something a little less awesome because I don't know why I tend to gravitate in these films. Like I said before, it's the dialogue parts of the Avengers I like the best. And as much as I like big action stuff, at least at this moment, what's kind of resonating to me is Gordon. I don't know if I would call this a favorite moment, but it's a moment that stands out to me. Let me put it that way. And it's one that I remember when I come back to the film. Gordon, when he's with young Bruce, you know, and
how have we not even talked about Gordon?
I think in that moment where just talking purely from a standpoint of there are times as human beings that we just absolutely feel helpless to help. You know, like we want to help and we want to go to those that are suffering, but all we can do is sit with them, you know, and we want to just take the world's problem, especially if it's somebody we really love or, you know, somebody in our family or whatever. And they're just suffering the biggest loss that we could imagine. And there are just those moments where we want to go, I wish I could just make the whole world better, but about all I can do is just sit here with you in silence. And and that scene where Gordon's just with him as a boy, I don't know there's anything profound about it, but I always remember that as someone who's had some losses in my life, and I've had good friends that have, one in particular that I remember those moments where they literally didn't say a word and they just sat with me, you know. And Gordon is a great character, I think, and I love Gary Oldman. But if I was going to say a moment that I find one of the most poignant, I'll say that as my favorite because I tend to gravitate to those moments. But just even that moment there of just embodying what it means to just sort of be in solidarity with a person. And you can tell, here's this man that's a father himself, and he wants to do something to help, and really about all he can do is just assure him, we're going to do all we can, you know, but I'm just going to sit here with you, you know. And then, again, that gets referenced in the third movie, like it or not, when I can't remember the line that Batman uses, but, you know, it's because
one time a man
that's right,
put his arms around a child, let him know the world wasn't ending.
Right. And so I don't know. I guess I'll say that is one of my favorite moments in the film.
No, so I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I was going to say mine was probably going to be a little what I would consider out of the box, based on all the things that you could legitimately pick in this movie, because there are a lot of good moments in this. And I think the reason this stuck out to me, and I think was my favorite part, it's because it reminded me why I like this movie so much. And as the trilogy went on, I tended to like it less. And then when we got Man of Steel, I didn't like it really almost at all. And it's because something levied against the DC kind of universe right now is the fact that there is no humor in it.
Right.
Like, you're not allowed to tell a joke. You're not allowed to laugh. You're not allowed to crack wise. That is not allowed. And this movie, even though it is dark, like visually, thematically, like it's dealing with a lot of stuff, there are so many funny lines in this movie. I like almost every time Alfred or Lucius, or even Gordon, like they talk, they almost like give you like a one-liner real quick.
Uh-huh.
Heck, even when Gordon's like, oh, I gotta get me one of those, you know, just like, it's almost like these corny lines, or I mean, like every time, like Morgan Freeman just like says these lines, like these knowing things to Bruce,
mm-hmm.
and then has that little Morgan Freeman smile at the end, like, oh, the tumbler, you wouldn't be interested in that, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
I'm just sitting there giddy, like smiling, because I know exactly like what he's thinking, you know?
Right.
It's just, when he chastises him, and there's this whole thing that these three characters kind of come together and are like this adoptive father to Bruce. Like I said, this, you know, JR's like, oh, we didn't even get to Gordon. You're like, this whole topic we didn't even get to. It's one of my favorite things, because their humanity, I think, kind of keeps pulling Bruce back to the world. And it's like, this is why you're doing this. This is why you're doing this. And I think we see, as the trilogy continues, they're the ones that continue to keep him grounded when things get bigger and bigger in scale. And so the fact that this movie allows itself to let the audience laugh, I think is a really big deal.
Huh.
And I think it makes it feel like a visually dark Marvel movie more than it does like what we get from DC these days.
Huh.
So that was my running theory from last night. So
You didn't think the S stands for hope was hilarious?
Well, I thought it was like laugh out loud funny, but not for the reasons they wanted it to be. So with that, we have probably, I don't know how long this is going to end up being after editing, but I know we've gone a pretty long time, as it is easy to do with this film. But I still want to make sure we have time to let you guys know, or let you guys give a chance to let our audience know how they can get a hold of you, how they can keep the conversation going. So Rick, where can people find your work, what you're up to, and how to get a hold of you if they want to?
RickLeeJames.com, and you can find me on Twitter at RickLeeJames, and my podcast is called Voices in My Head, and I'll just leave it at that.
Awesome. JR?
I have, I'm on Twitter and Facebook at JR Forresteros, and then I have several podcasts, including The Storyman, which is my main podcast, Storyman.us, and then if you go to NorvalRogers.com/podcast, that is where all my other podcasts are listed. I have one on horror movies. I have one on like Christian education, kind of like we call it Sunday school for the 21st century, some different stuff like that. And yeah, all that's at NorvalRogers.com, which is the blog that I do with the other Storymen. That's Shaggy's real name from Scooby-Doo, if you can't remember what it is. So,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's all the places to find me.
I was gonna say, and I'll put all that stuff in the show notes in case you want to go and find that. You can catch it. You can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook. As always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. Let us know in the comments or on Facebook or wherever, what were your favorite moments or themes from Batman Begins? Where does it rank among your comic book films? You know, like I said, keep the conversation going. We're grateful for our excellent guests, so please follow them on social media and follow the work they're doing around the interwebs. Meanwhile, we're also very, very thankful for you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
He's back.
I'm back. Sorry about that. That was...
He's back.
Unbelievable.
That was amazing. Me and Rick just had the most amazingly revelatory conversation.
You just cracked it all. It's done.
We did.
Yeah. I can't wait to hear it when I listen back to this episode.
Good night, everybody. It was good to be here.
Thanks for coming. The Da Vinci Code is solved. You're welcome. Thank you.
And it's pronounced, we discovered it's pronounced Ra's al Ghul, I think.
Ra's al Ghul.
Who knows?